Well, good afternoon and welcome everyone. My name is Victoria Weeks and I have the great privilege of being the President of FINSIA and really pleased to welcome you here today to our webinar, The Regulator's Priorities Updated. Before I introduce our panel, I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which each of us in Australia is joining the webinar. Though we may be physically distant, each of us is on the land of traditional owners, and I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present and to any First Nations people with us today. And a very warm welcome to all of you, and in particular to the leaders of our regulators who are with us today. Wayne Byres, Chair of the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, Philip Lowe, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, and James Shipton, Chair of the Australian Securities and Investments Commission. FINSIA's special session of the regulators is really a reflection of FINSIA's and our members' commitment to a strong and vibrant banking and financial services sector and the really important role that our regulators play in our industry's standing. As we face the enormous impact of COVID-19 on the economy, it's clear that the priorities of our regulators have had to respond to help meet the challenges we all now face, whether it's the industry or the community. Notwithstanding these challenges, I'm confident that they really present an opportunity for the industry to reaffirm its commitment to customers and to further restore community trust. I believe it's also an opportunity to do more for our customers by supporting and empowering our people. Giving our financial services colleagues the skills through training, the tools through technology, and the values to act in an ethical and responsible manner that put the customer at the centre of what we do will pay great dividends. At the same time, given the importance of economic recovery, we all want to see businesses confident of a pathway to reopening, and people given the flexibility to be able to restore their financial well-being as and when the opportunity arises, whether through superannuation or other means. Whilst it's important for the industry not to forget the lessons of the Royal Commission, and I certainly haven't, we clearly need to take account of the crisis we're now facing and find the best way for the economy and the community to emerge from COVID stronger and more resilient than before. I think it's been really pleasing to see over the last few months the incredible collaboration across politics, government, business and the workforce in the way that I've never seen before. The need for speedy decision making has necessitated a highly collaborative approach and one that's based on trust in our collective good intentions. And Australia seems to have embraced that. And we should particularly commend our regulators for playing their part. Industry similarly has had to make some rapid changes and adapt the way it works. As an independent financial services professional body, FINSIA is also playing its part and adapting to the new world. But our commitment to professionalism and professional standards remains steadfast. What's been demonstrated by the events of 2020 is that the key to resilience and agility is to have a strong, supported and resilient people at the heart of our industry, whether you're a bank CEO or at the front line dealing with customers every day. And FINSIA also believes that means having a commitment as an industry to building professionalism and professional standards at all levels, to insist on the highest standards of conduct and competency so that we can continue to restore trust in the industry, pride for the financial services community, and to deliver better outcomes for our customers. And so to our speakers today. I'm not going to read out their bios because we have limited time and I'm sure you're much more interested in hearing for them. But as I'm sure you'll agree, they all have impeccable credentials. So the way we're going to run the session is that each of our speakers will provide 10 minutes of introductory remarks and then we'll have a Q&A session, which is going to be moderated by Chris Whitehead, FINSIA's CEO and Managing Director. Just so you know, each of our speakers' formal remarks will be available on their website and we'll send you the links following the session today. We're also going to have some time for audience Q&A, so please use the Q&A function in the Zoom app. To ask a question, use the Q&A button, which is at the bottom of your screen, and type your question. Please do make those questions succinct, no speeches, as it's much easier to manage a Q&A when we're very clear what the questions are. We mightn't get through all the questions. We will certainly do our best. If there are some that we need to take on notice, we'll do so and get back after the webinar. As you will appreciate, we are all in different locations today, so we apologise if the Q&A may not be as seamless as it might otherwise be. We do have a business continuity plan, so if one of us drops out, please be patient. We'll do our best to keep things going and reconnect. So I now have great pleasure in introducing the first of our speakers, Philip Lowe, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia and Chair of the Council of Financial Regulators, to provide his opening remarks. Over to you, Philip.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much, Victoria, and thank you to FINSIA for putting this event together. I also want to thank you for your work in raising professional standards in Australia's financial sector. This work is important in helping restore trust in our financial institutions, as is the effort by the institutions themselves to help support the national effort to overcome COVID-19. As Chair of the Council of Financial Regulators, I'd like to begin with a few remarks about the recent work of the Council, and then I'll say a few words about the economic outlook. As I hope you all know, the Council of Financial Regulators brings together the heads of APRA, ASIC, the Australian Treasury and the RBA. It serves as a clearinghouse for ideas and a forum for the discussion of issues affecting the stability of Australia's financial system. While it does not have formal powers, it has established an incredibly strong cooperative culture that's helped Australia's financial regulators work very closely together over recent times. When things were moving very quickly through much of March and April, the Council met frequently, holding conference calls at least weekly, with the Australian Treasurer joining some of these conference calls. At the staff level, our agencies were meeting daily. Recently, we've also been having calls with our counterparts in New Zealand under the umbrella of the Trans-Tasman Council on Banking Supervision. In the difficult days of mid-March, the Council made a number of public statements focused on four key points, and I'd like to use this opportunity today to run through those points again. The first is that the Australian financial system is resilient and it's very well placed to deal with COVID-19. In particular, the system has large capital and liquidity buffers, and it's made substantial investments in operational resilience. The system is in this strong position partly because over the past decade, APRA has worked with financial institutions to boost their capital and to reduce their liquidity risks. Australia's financial institutions are also highly profitable, and they've had very low levels of problem loans over recent years. The second point is that the capital and liquidity buffers are available to be drawn upon if required to support the economy. And I'd really like to re-emphasise this point today. If there was ever a time to allow these buffers to be used, now is that time. We should not expect to see capital buffers be maintained during a once-in-a-century shock. These buffers have been built up to be used in events such as this, and some reduction in capital ratios is entirely appropriate as lenders support their customers through this difficult period. The third and related point that the Council wanted to emphasise is that it's important that lenders continue to support the flow of credit to the economy. The Council is committed to assisting this process. The Reserve Bank, through its package of policy measures, is doing what it can do to keep funding costs low and credit available. The government has granted a six-month exemption from responsible lending obligations where lenders provide credit to existing customers who run small businesses. And consistent with this, ASIC has been encouraging lenders to work closely with customers to provide short-term assistance to support their longer-term viability. And APRA has announced temporary changes to its expectations regarding bank capital ratios. So there's been a lot done by the Council members to support the flow of credit. The fourth and final point made by the Council was that the regulators have been very conscious of the need to adjust the timing of their initiatives to allow financial institutions to focus on serving their customers. And in the case of the RBA, we put on hold the review of retail payments regulation. While we're continuing to do work on this review in the background, it will not be completed until next year. So these have been the four key messages, and I'm sure my colleagues will expand on these during the webinar. I'd now like to turn to the economy. We're clearly living through the biggest and the most sudden economic contraction since the 1930s. Unlike previous contractions, this one is not being caused by a financial event or by macroeconomic policies. Rather, it's the result of society's efforts to contain a pandemic. Last week, we had a stark reminder of the very human cost of these efforts. With almost 600,000 Australians losing their jobs in April and more than 750,000 people on 0 hours. All up, total hours worked in Australia fell by an unprecedented 9% in April. It's a staggering number. The labour market data that post-date April's labour force survey suggests a further decline in hours worked in May, although the decline does not look to be as large as it was in April. If this is an accurate gauge, then it is possible that the total decline in hours worked will be less than earlier feared as firms make use of the JobKeeper wage subsidy. Just as the nature of this economic contraction is different, so too has been the fiscal and monetary policy response. This response has been built around the idea that we need to build a bridge to the point where the virus is contained and the capacity of our health system has been scaled up so it can cope. In my view, this has been the right approach, and it's involved coordinated and unprecedented monetary and fiscal policy measures. The banks too have been part of building this bridge through their repayment deferrals and the provision of credit to businesses. Yet despite all these efforts, the future does remain unusually uncertain. One obvious source of uncertainty is the pace at which the various restrictions will be eased. The faster that the restrictions can be lifted safely, the sooner and the stronger the economic bounce back will be and the less economic scarring will take place. But this is not the only source of uncertainty. Another source is the level of confidence that people have about their future, both in terms of their own health and their own finances. It's interesting that the initial evidence is that countries that have had fewer restrictions are also experiencing very large contractions in economic activity. This suggests that the voluntary decisions that people have made in response to the uncertainty about their health and about their finances are also playing a major role. In the face of this uncertainty, it's understandable people have been reluctant to go out and spend and businesses have been reluctant to invest. This points to a critical issue for us here in Australia. That is restoring people's confidence on two fronts. The first is the confidence that we can go about our lives and remain healthy. And the second is the confidence that we'll have jobs and incomes tomorrow, and that the economy will once again grow strongly again. On the economic front, the Reserve Bank's package of policy measures announced in mid-March will help. That package was designed to keep funding costs low and credit available. It included cutting the cash rate to 25 basis points, targeting a yield of 25 basis points for three-year Australian government bonds, and making a term funding facility available to the banks to support credit to businesses, especially small and medium-sized businesses. The early evidence is that these measures are working as expected. Banks have reduced their lending rates to record lows, with interest rates for small businesses declining the most. And the yield on three-year bonds have settled at the target, and the government bond market in Australia is working well again. That's good news. To date, the RBA has bought around $50 billion of government bonds. We've scaled back our purchases recently as conditions in the market have improved, and over the past week, we've not purchased any bonds at all. We do, though, remain prepared to scale up these bond purchases again if necessary to achieve the yield curve target and to assist with the smooth functioning of the market. There is, though, a limit to what can be achieved with monetary policy. Fiscal support through this difficult period has also been crucial and will continue to be crucial over the months ahead. So, too, will be a reinvigorated economic reform agenda. It gives the community the confidence that once the virus has passed, we can move quickly out of the economic shadow it's casting. As I've said on other occasions, there's no shortage of reports filled with ideas of how to do this and how to make Australia a great place for businesses to expand, to invest, to innovate, and to hire people. If we can take up some of these ideas, we can once again experience strong and sustainable growth. Australia's financial institutions also have an important role to play in helping us get there. They are helping us build the bridge to the point where the virus is contained and our economy recovers. As part of this effort, it's both understandable and desirable that lenders draw on the buffers that were built up in better times. It's in the bank's own interests and in the interests of the broader Australian community that they support their customers now and also support them in the recovery phase when credit will be needed so that Australian businesses can once again expand. Thank you, Victoria.
Thanks, Philip, for those remarks. I'd like now to introduce Wayne Byers, Chair of APRA, to give his opening remarks. Wayne.
Well, thank you very much, Victoria, and thank you to Fincia for setting up today's webinar. I'm a long-time member and a great supporter of Fincia's efforts to improve professional standards across the industry. So very happy to be part of today's events, and thank you again for organising it. Before I say a few words about APRA's response to the virus, I do want to just reiterate Phil's comments about the successful and very important coordinating role that the Council of Financial Regulators is playing at present in ensuring our actions are pursued to promote the best financial system impact and outcomes for the benefits of the Australian community. And Phil does a great job chairing it, and it's a very important part of Australia's economic response to COVID-19. From APRA's perspective, critical to our COVID-19 response has been the underlying strength of the financial system. Australia was fortunate to enter 2020 with a financial sector in good financial health overall. The sector's been quite resilient from an operational perspective as well, and both of those things have proven very valuable in navigating the past few months. As Phil said, that strength is the product of a concerted and a persistent effort by the industry, reinforced by regulators, to build up resilience during the good times. That age-old adage of saving for rainy day is never more apt than now. And we're glad we did it, even though it's not always easy or popular at the time. So, for example, compared to the 08-09 financial crisis or even the 91-92 recession, the major banks have entered this period with much stronger balance sheets. Capital is higher, liquidity and funding profiles are stronger, and asset quality is better. And more importantly, the broader Australian banking system is well capitalised by both historical and international standards. The CET1 capital ratio of the banking system, the key metric of financial soundness, was above 11% during pretty much all of 2019. Going into the GFC, the equivalent ratio would have been roughly half that. So that strength has been a virtue over the past few months, and it has allowed Australian banks to play a role as a shock absorber for the economy. And it's not just the banks who've had the strength to contribute to the immediate response. Insurers have been able to support customers by modifying terms and conditions to help those affected by the virus. And the superannuation sector is obviously playing a role in promptly dealing with payments under the government's early release scheme. So all of these things are helping to soften the blow of what, as Phil described, a very severe economic contraction over the past couple of months. Now, we regulators have had a role to play too. And I think showing just how fast moving this crisis has been, in January, we at APRA published a pretty comprehensive policy and supervisory agenda for 2020. And less than 8 weeks later, we announced the deferral of most of it until the end of September at the earliest. And realistically, many items won't restart until 2021. Now, it is important to note why we did this. It wasn't because the original set of plans were ill-directed. or we've had any change of heart. Rather, it was to allow financial firms to dedicate their time and resources to maintaining their operations and supporting customers in a time of need, while also enabling us at APRA to intensify our focus on monitoring and responding to the impact of firms' financial and operational capacity. For the industry and for APRA, I think COVID-19 has really been a case of all hands on deck, and we'll come back to our broader agenda once we have a better sense of the landscape that's ahead of us. Now, beyond deferring many activities, one of the first actions we took was to issue a statement regarding the unquestionably strong capital benchmarks. We set those benchmarks, very fortuitously, to be achieved by the start of 2020, to ensure banks were well capitalised in the event of stress. And we therefore moved quickly and simultaneously with the announcement of the term funding facility by the Reserve Bank to relax those expectations. Now, as I noted earlier, bank capital ratios have been at historical highs, and that capital has been built up precisely so that banks are able, in times such as these, to absorb losses and sustain the flow of credit to the broader economy. So I can only repeat Phil's point and emphasise it. Now is the time to allow that to happen. It does mean capital ratios will come down over the year ahead, and that should surprise no one. So, for example, major bank CET1 ratios below 10% again are to be expected. And as that occurs, we do need to keep it in perspective. Less than 3 years ago, the aggregate major bank CET1 ratio had never been above 10%. So our message to make use of capital buffers to support economic activity has been strong, but it hasn't been obviously without strings attached. Capital can essentially be used for three purposes: to sustain and grow a business, to absorb losses, or to reward shareholders. And we clearly prefer capital buffers to be utilised for the first two. And as a result of that, we wrote to banks and insurers in early April asking that they seriously consider deferring or at least materially reducing discretionary capital distributions in the months ahead. And a number have chosen to defer dividends, while those that paid have generally offset them with other capital raisings. Now, I want to stress we didn't intervene on dividends lightly. We fully recognise the important role they play in the investment returns of many Australians. However, our mandate's first and foremost to protect the safety of bank depositors and ensure insurers have the means to pay claims. So while decisions like this on dividends are invariably difficult, we believe we have chosen a balanced approach. We hope the impact on dividends from the current COVID-19 crisis will be temporary. But obviously, the outlook remains highly, highly uncertain. And we therefore believe prudence is the appropriate strategy for the time being. Our approach is ultimately designed to underpin financial system stability over the longer term, and that is ultimately to the benefit of all Australians. The other action I want to quickly touch on is in relation to bank loan deferrals. I should stress that we at APRA don't determine whether and in what form banks choose to offer support to their customers. But we do have a role, and we do decide the capital and reporting treatment of those loans, and that's a subtle but important distinction. Now, again, the reason we were comfortable granting capital concessions to banks offering loan deferrals was because even though we know, unfortunately, not all customers will recover, banks have a strong starting position to absorb eventual losses. Now, this was another on-balance judgment, weighing up the risks and the benefits. Banks' ability to provide support is not limitless, but we're very firmly of the view it was the right decision for the time. It's not without risk, however, and in the interest of transparency, we've also asked banks to disclose the extent of the deferrals granted, so that investors and markets can understand the impact. So if I sum up through all of our actions, what are we trying to do? Well, we're trying to facilitate an orderly adjustment to the post-COVID world. I'd stress that doesn't mean hiding from reality. It doesn't mean hiding from change, but we can help facilitate an adjustment that's not excessively disruptive. And the actions that I've talked about and the others that we've taken and will take are very much designed with that goal in mind. So thank you very much, and I'll hand back to you, Victoria.
Thanks so much, Wayne, for those remarks. I'd like now to hand over to James Shipton, Chair of ASIC, for his opening remarks. James.
Thanks very much, Victoria. And thanks to you and Finzia for this important initiative. ASIC is a keen supporter of Finzia's initiative to promote greater professionalism in the financial services industry. Let me start by agreeing with the observations of my colleagues, Philip and Wayne, especially regarding the importance of the Council of Financial Regulators as a key forum for regulatory coordination. Having spent much of my professional career abroad, I am convinced that Australia is incredibly well served by its regulatory institutions and lucky to have the leadership from people such as Philip and Wayne. In times like these, institutional credibility of our economic and financial public institutions is absolutely paramount. ASIC is playing its part in responding to the current crisis, and this requires that we make some changes to our approach. That said, our important role and mandate will always endure and apply in whatever the circumstances. Achieving our vision for a fair, strong, and efficient financial system for all Australians depends on it. In the coming weeks, we will announce a revised set of strategic priorities for the next few months. However, today, I can outline our adjusted approach, as well as some of the work we have been doing in response to the crisis. There are five key areas I would like to briefly touch on now. They are ASIC's regulatory work and priorities for the time being, our work to ensure Australia's capital markets continue to serve the real economy by operating in a fair, orderly, and efficient manner, our continued enforcement work where there is significant risk of consumer harm, the enhancement of information for consumers on our MoneySmart website, and increased targeted consumer messaging. And finally, through all of this, making clear to regulated entities our expectations on how to deal with their customers. Firstly, ASIC has recognised the extraordinary demands placed on businesses and the broader economy by COVID-19. Accordingly, ASIC has changed its regulatory priorities for the time being. This has meant the deferral of some activities and redeployment of staff so that we can address issues of immediate concern. Critically, this enables us to focus on key challenges such as maintaining the integrity of markets and protecting vulnerable consumers. Examples of this approach include deferral of less time critical reviews, supervisory initiatives and investigations, no action relief for entities holding shareholder meetings that is now extended until late 2020, and 6-month delays of the final implementation of the best interest duty for mortgage brokers and the design and distribution obligations for financial product issuers. It is important to note that this is not an abrogation of our regulatory work. Instead, it is a recognition that some existing activities and new tasks must take precedence over the work we would otherwise be doing in order to respond to the pandemic. Secondly, ASIC has acted to ensure that Australia's equity and capital markets have continued to operate in a fair, orderly, and efficient manner. We have done this by quickly imposing a daily limit on the total number of ASX and Chi-X equity trades following a huge volume spike back in March. This action prevented delays in settlement that would have undermined investor confidence in the market and the wider economy at a critical and fragile time. We've now relaxed this requirement, but continue to specifically monitor trading volumes as well as the market more broadly. We also authorised the ASX's relaxation of rules that limited share placements by listed companies. By doing so, we enhance the ability of companies to bolster their balance sheets in a liquidity-constrained environment. We did this by keeping in mind fairness issues, so that boards are also required to explain to shareholders why the type of offer was necessary and how mum and dad shareholders could also participate. As a result of these actions and the robustness of Australia's capital markets, listed companies have raised in excess of $21 billion in 80 transactions since the COVID-19 crisis began. This is vital to support the real economy in a time of severe economic strain. It also shows that Australia is a world leader in terms of our capital markets stepping up to support Australian companies and the Australian economy when it is most needed. Thirdly, we continue to investigate, enforce, and prosecute breaches of the law where there is significant risk of consumer harm. This is particularly important at a time when the community is being asked to bear a very heavy burden in meeting the economic and social costs of the recovery. Past illegal conduct, including behaviour identified by the Hayne Royal Commission, must continue to be a priority. Moreover, swift action must be taken where firms or individuals attempt to take advantage of consumers at a time of heightened vulnerability and financial strain. To this point, ASIC has actively sought to warn consumers where they are at risk of financial harm, including with warnings about unlicensed and inappropriate financial advice and warnings about scams and fraud. Fourth, we have also sought to help Australians find appropriate advice when making important financial decisions at this time of significant economic stress. We have done this by enhancing information on our MoneySmart website and through targeted consumer messaging. This has included advice on our MoneySmart website about what to take into account if Australians are considering drawing on their superannuation and how best to go about doing so. Guidance on our MoneySmart website for consumers to make good decisions about loan repayments, including if they are considering a repayment deferral. Health warnings to retail shareholders on how to avoid being taken advantage of and what to be aware of when trading in such volatile market conditions. This work involved a rapid review and analysis of retail investor trading and performance in equities and contracts for differences during the early stages of the pandemic. And finally, warnings to consumers about misleading advertising of financial products that are made to seem safer than they really are. Finally, through all of this, ASIC will continue to make clear to regulated entities our expectations on how they should behave. Despite the challenges posed by COVID-19, ASIC expects entities to treat customers fairly, avoid adding further financial harm or burden, and act to maintain the integrity and efficiency of markets. In other words, we expect the industry to adopt a stance of utmost professionalism in everything they do right now. For our part, we have written to lenders and insurers setting out our expectations. We did the same together with APRA for superannuation trustees. And we also published FAQs for financial advisors. Regardless of the prevailing circumstances, the financial services sector continues to have community-oriented obligations under the law, including, where applicable, to act honestly, fairly and efficiently, report material breaches of the law, maintain proper records of financial services they provide, and ensure appropriate supervision of financial and credit services and activities, even where staff are working remotely. In closing, there has never been a greater need for the financial services industry to live up to the professional expectations of the community. More than ever before, we and the community expect financial services professionals to perform their crucial roles competently and conscientiously. That is, with the utmost professionalism. Once again, I'm grateful to Finzia for creating this forum and its ongoing work to promote professionalism in financial services. I'll hand back now to Victoria, and I look forward to the panel discussion and answering your questions.
Thanks so much, James. Now I have to hand over to Chris, who's going to moderate the Q&A. And I can see there's a whole lot of questions come in as well as the ones Chris has got ready. So over to you, Chris.
Great. Thank you very much indeed, Victoria and panelists, for your introductory remarks. And a quick reminder to participants, the Q&A button at the bottom of your screens is how you can add to those questions. I'll kick off with a question for Wayne and then James. Which is that the pandemic crisis hit us all very quickly. Stakeholders have moved very quickly to respond. How well do you think overall our financial services companies have responded? Wayne.
Thanks, Chris. I have to say, as I said in my remarks, I think things thus far have gone very well. So we had a financially resilient system, and that's obviously really important. That's a fundamental precondition to being able to respond well. But the operational resilience has always been there. We've had what is effectively an industry executed BCP plans, and that has gone well. And then not only has there been an effort to keep the system running, and that's been done very well in a very disruptive time, but the industry has worked very collaboratively, particularly through the industry associations, to find ways, coordinated ways, to offer support to the broader community. And I think that's been very positive. It hasn't just been one entity doing one thing and another entity another, but there's been a real system-wide, industry-wide focus on how do they contribute to helping us bridge to the other side. So I think overall it has been a very positive response.
James, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, well, I firstly wanted to agree wholeheartedly with Wayne about a very positive response. I would also observe the significant shift in resources and attention to consumer and customer-focused issues. The challenge will be into the future because we have some way to go. There's a lot of issues to work through. And this is why staying the course on the starting approach is going to be so absolutely crucial, because there's going to be, unfortunately, issues to work through when it comes to the customers and the consumers, and they will be difficult. And the best way that we would like to see that work through is through with fairness and adherence, obviously, to the legal obligations. This is where, you know, professionalism, conscientiousness and competency is so absolutely important. I'd also ask that as we embark upon this, you know, this journey, which it will be in our response in the industry, that whilst it's absolutely crucial to focus in on the numbers, absolutely, we must not lose sight of the non-financial risks. We must not lose sight of consumer and customer-oriented risks. And we must not lose sight of, more broadly, the non-financial risks, because coming out of the financial crisis, the last one at least, is that, yes, there were lessons to be learned in relation to financial risks, as there are now, economic risks, as there are now, but non-financial risks will also endure.
Great. Thank you very much. And perhaps turning to Philip, James just referred to some of the lessons from the last crisis, and we do seem to have benefited from the lessons of the GFC, for instance, the immediate focus on liquidity. What are the key lessons so far? We obviously have still much more to learn, perhaps, but what do you think of the key lessons we've learned so far?
Thanks, Chris. Just before I talk about the lessons, can I just add one other point to the ones that James and Wayne made about the response of the financial sector to the virus, and that's to focus on the very good performance of our financial market infrastructures. Over recent years, there's been a conscious policy decision to have more settlement through the CCPs, and The Australian CCPs, and we've seen this elsewhere around the world, have stood up very well to high volumes of trading and very large lift in volatility. So the financial market infrastructures have been working well as well. In terms of lessons, maybe there are three that I could briefly touch on. The first is the importance of having buffers in the system. Now, we know the world is uncertain. We don't know where the future shocks are going to come from, but we need to have buffers to deal with those shocks. Those buffers are expensive to hold in normal times, and sometimes people complain, but in stress times like the one we're living through now, we just see how valuable they are. The second general lesson, I saw this both in the financial crisis a decade ago and now, is confidence is incredibly fragile, and restoring it is key to both financial stability and to economic recovery. The policymakers can help restore confidence with a credible, well-communicated, comprehensive plan. I think we've done that in Australia, and that's helping restore confidence, and in time it will help with the economic recovery. So doing whatever we can to restore confidence is key. And the third lesson is that contingency planning is incredibly important. I think we've benefited the Reserve Bank from thinking in advance about what we would do in extraordinary circumstances, and the Council of Financial Regulators. We've also discussed previously what we would do in extraordinary circumstances. So that contingency planning has allowed us to move very quickly when we needed to and do extraordinary things. And I think the same is true in the banking system, where they've done strong contingency planning. They were very well positioned to move quickly.
Great. Thank you very much. A question to James, perhaps. With the pandemic creating a lot of uncertainty around employment and incomes over the short and medium term, how do lenders need to adapt in their consideration of serviceability?
Well, let me just sort of answer that question through the prism of our regulatory handle, which is the responsible lending obligations. And ultimately, we believe that there has always been enough inherent discretion and flexibility in those largely principal-based obligations for lenders to apply their discretion, their best discretion in different circumstances. In effect, that principles-based obligation is now being put to the utmost test, and we believe that it still provides enough flexibility for lenders to exercise their good judgment, their professional judgment, in order to make the correct decisions, because that correct decision ultimately will be a credit one, and that is a credit and a commercial decision by the bank and by the lenders, which of course is theirs to make. But we believe, particularly with the reinforced clarifications that we've had in recent times, that we certainly allow enough inherent flexibility in those principle-based obligations so that bankers can make hopefully the right decisions considering all of the circumstances, the prevailing circumstances, both more broadly and also specifically about the borrower, the customer.
Thank you very much indeed, James. I'm now starting to move to some participant questions, and we're getting quite a lot of those, so thank you very much. From Peter Deans, a question for the RBA Governor. It is looking like Australia will emerge from this crisis somewhat earlier than overseas countries. How much of a drag does the RBA see major regions such as the USA and Europe as perhaps holding back the local recovery?
Well, I don't think that's the main thing holding back the local recovery. It's really kind of restoring confidence. That's what we need. As I said earlier, it's restoring confidence on the health front. I think that's a precondition for a strong recovery. That would help both in Australia and globally. I mean, we might get a vaccine, we might get some antiviral medication, but it's also possible that we don't. So we have an incredible lot riding on the work of the scientists. But if we don't get breakthroughs on the medical front, then I think it's going to be quite a slow recovery. And it's not the fact that the rest of the world is growing slowly. It's just that everyone is going to be nervous about their health, so they won't want to spend. and that's going to be a global issue.
Great, thank you. Another member question. This is perhaps best to Wayne initially. Is October going to be a challenge? As the bank's moratorium ends, JobSeeker and so on, how do you keep the financial system robust post this COVID support, or as this COVID support changes?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's one that I hesitate to try and answer today, because I think this has been a very fast-moving crisis. It's a rapidly evolving situation, and one of the things I think you need to avoid when there's a high degree of uncertainty and things are changing rapidly is trying to lock yourself into a solution too early. Given the pace with which things are happening, September, October is actually still a long way away, and we'll have a lot more information then about how well the reopening has gone, whether it's gone faster or slower than we expect, what the economic impacts have been. So we'll understand the nature of the problem better. And so clearly we want to make sure that that just doesn't become a cliff, and that we hit a cliff and all of the support disappears at once when the economy and borrowers and the banking system, the financial system, is not ready to deal with that. But a lot of people are asking me that question, what are we going to do at the end of the 6 months? And I'm wary of trying to answer it just today, because I think we don't have enough knowledge as to what the nature or the likely path will be just at this point. And that'll have a big bearing on the solution. So that's probably an unsatisfactory answer, but it's my best answer.
Great. And I think we've all at times learned the lesson of managing expectations in our careers. Understand where you're coming from on that. Philip or James, is there anything you'd like to add to that, or we can move to the next question?
I'll make one supplement if I could, which is, and absolutely reinforcing everything that Wayne said, is that there's actually things that we can collectively do now. And the we is everybody in the industry participating in this webinar, which is to check in with their customers, their consumers, to see, you know, what's happening now, whether the decisions made a couple of weeks ago, a month ago, stand, how the circumstances have changed. All of us need to collectively lean into this challenge. All of us need to help and assist Australians, customers, consumers, navigate their way through it. So, yes, I absolutely agree with the Wayne's point about it's premature to say what's going to happen in X month's time. I'd really impress upon everybody on this call and more broadly is there's things we can do now to try and manage for the future.
Great, thank you. Perhaps this one's best directed to Philip, and this is from Steve Samogi. Excellent work by the Council of Financial Regulators to date. The immediate and temporary loosening of the regulatory framework to support economic activity and protection has been very impressive and indeed crucial in cushioning the blow to Australia. The light at the other end of the tunnel is not yet available, but at some stage the loosening will need to be tightened and normality regained. When do you anticipate that will be? Is that sort of into the next year or beyond?
Well, it's a good question. I wish I knew the answer to it. It depends very much upon when the economy is growing robustly again. It's not appropriate to tighten things up until we're experiencing robust growth. That links back to my previous question. We've got a lot resting on the shoulders of the scientists here.
Great. Thank you. A question for James. We're getting a number of questions here. I'll sort of aggregate those. With regards to the financial advice, and, of course, the impacts on personal, individual Australians with regards to the provision of advice. And we've seen a lot of change there and, indeed, some fall in some of the numbers of financial advisors. Do you think what's your thoughts with regards to the ensuring we have adequate financial advice to Australians as they seek to recover personally from this crisis as well?
Well, I think it's a great question because this was a question which was confronting us before the pandemic. It's clearly being affected by, as most things, if not everything, is being affected by the pandemic itself. So there's a couple of things that I'll quickly respond to. Firstly, it's always been our desire to have a healthy, functioning and effective financial advice industry in this country. And, you know, we want to work with industry, we want to work with policymakers, we want to work with the government to make sure that that is the ultimate result. But we also need to ensure that it is the highest quality and of the highest standard, and that is absolutely crucial and absolutely necessary. The second point is that we've adapted and responded to the immediate challenges by providing some relief for financial advice so that Australians can get access to it with some of the critical questions that are now before them. And I think as we sort of work through, as we endure, the industry, policymakers, regulators need to work together to see how we can shape the financial advice sector to future-proof it so that it can actively serve and be beneficial to Australians and the broader economy. And let me just sort of say again that this was an issue that we were monitoring going into the pandemic, and our attention and focus to it has only enhanced because of it, because we certainly see the incredible importance of financial planning and financial advice to Australians.
Thank you. A question here, anonymous, but to Wayne and Philip. COVID-19 leads to significant decentralisation and a move away from cities. How much of a threat might that pose? I mean, perhaps I'll widen that out and say, you know, we do expect that, you know, things are going to change quite significantly. You know, post-COVID-19 will be different to pre-COVID-19. And I guess this is all about sustainability. And so perhaps if you'd like to comment, Wayne, do you want to kick off with that one in terms of what some of the longer term impacts and how it might impact on assets and the economy going forwards?
Well, I think the only thing we can say with certainty at this point is, to the extent that the shape of the economy changes, to the extent that there are structural shifts, then it's quite reasonable to think there will be shifts in asset prices, and different assets will have different values in the future to the ones they've had up until this point. But I don't think we really know. I mean, there's a lot of speculation. You know, the CBD office is dead. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. We shall see. The key thing for whether that causes stress and strain in the financial system is less about the nature of the shift and more about the time horizon over which it occurs. Because if it is a gradual shift, if it's a shift that occurs over years, then the system will adjust and financial institutions will adjust and values will adjust, and it will be in an orderly fashion. The shocks and stresses to systems come when there is a snap adjustment or a very fast adjustment. I mean, that's the broader economic issue we have at present, that the economy, large parts of the economy have kind of stopped for a minute, and that's where the strain comes from. But I think some of these broader issues about what will it mean for property prices, it's difficult to tell, and I think it will play out over time, and therefore, while I'm quite confident it will have an impact, I'm also, reasonably okay at this point that I think that impact will be manageable because it's likely to play out over a period. I mean, Phil may have a slightly different perspective, but I think I'm not unduly concerned by that at this point.
Right. And Phil, perhaps turning to that, and maybe also one of the comments that we made is much greater impact of technology, digital innovation and so on. So the economy going forwards. Your comments.
Yeah, well, Chris, you prefaced your earlier question by saying, what are the threats? And as I heard you ask that question, I thought, well, what are the opportunities here? Yeah. Because we're seeing tremendous innovation in the business sector and the way services are delivered. And I would expect that once we're through this, that innovation will remain and we'll find new ways of doing business. So I see as many opportunities here as threats. And perhaps while I've got the floor, can I address one other question that I see as I read through the Q&A, or the questions has come up a few times, and the question that a number of people ask is, are we rethinking our views on negative interest rates? I said previously that it was extraordinarily unlikely that we would have negative interest rates and there's been no change to that thinking. The board is not contemplating having negative interest rates in Australia. I think the costs of that exceed the benefits. So thank you for that opportunity.
Great. Thank you. And yes, obviously, if any policy question pop up, do feel free to raise that. Moving on, and this is probably, again, more to James and then perhaps Wayne. You mentioned that several pieces of regulatory work have been deferred. When things do pick up again, to what extent will they be adjusted and to factor in learnings from the pandemic? A good example given here, and this is from Christian Ibrahim, is on offshoring, for instance, the impact of offshoring. Will some of those policies change? James, would you like to start on that one?
Well, I'll let Wayne take the offshoring aspects, but let me start off by saying, yeah, look, there's a number of things that we've deferred, but that doesn't mean that we don't want to do them. In fact, it is a core priority to come back and do these issues. There are also let's call them projects, work and policies that are now, as I was mentioning before, really getting stress tested in this extreme environment. So, of course, there's going to be lessons to be learned through this extreme environment as to the effectiveness and efficiency of regulation, because we've always been about the efficiency and the effectiveness of regulation. And, yes, we're going to be very attentive to how regulation and how we go about regulating performs during this particular point of crisis. And then we will also... see how we can adjust those issues that have been deferred, how we can improve upon them when we get back to working on them from what we've learnt during these stressful times.
Thanks. Wayne?
Oh, well, I'd agree with James. Yes, obviously we'll be reflecting on what we've learnt over the last couple of months and the next few months as we come back to the policy agenda. I think some of the policy agenda won't change. It'll only be reinforced by the current events. Big piece of work that we're still to complete is some work on bank capital. That's more important than ever, making sure banks have got the right capital. So that really won't change. Work on culture will be interesting, and the learnings that we've got from the way the industry is responding to current events. And then issues around operational resilience, cyber, all of those sort of things, there's great learnings at present. I think you mentioned offshoring, and I think that's a really interesting one. There is a very broad trend in the financial sector for at least for what we traditionally call outsourcing, whether it's offshoring or whether it's onshoring or whether it's onshore providers, but third-party providers increasingly providing services. And we're learning a lot about the resilience of those providers during this period. So that'll certainly be something we look at as we think about how to set up the regulatory framework in that area.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. Now, keeping an eye on our time, and we always pride ourselves on sticking to time, we only have a couple of minutes left. I really have reached the end of our Q&A opportunity. Unless any of the panelists would like to add any remarks, that the opportunity has not arisen so far, then what I'd like to do is obviously thank you very much indeed for your time today. It's been a tremendous opportunity for FINSIA and our members to hear from you, and a great privilege. So I'd like to thank you very much. Thank you also to all of those who have participated, all our members and guests, for your attendance today. And we will send that feedback link in the chat box for you now. So if you have a look at the chat box, you will see a link to feedback. Perhaps if I can move on to just mention it quickly, the FINSIA professionalism strategy, and Rachel can bring that up. As many of our members know, FINSIA is committed to building professional standards across the financial services industry. We've introduced a number of internationally recognised professional programs in the last year, which may be of interest. I know many are busier than ever, but also it's perhaps a time you might be thinking about the needs of the future and consider embarking on one of these programs. So whether it's professional banking fundamentals or artificial intelligence and so on. So, please do review those on our website, Green Finance, again, looking further into the future. That's under the education tab on the FinSEA website. To confirm, we'll send an email to you with the slides from today's meeting, as well as a recording from today. So thank you very much indeed for everyone for attending. To all of those who've been online, stay safe, healthy, and we hope to see you at the next webinar. Next week, we have a fascinating webinar on the Chinese economy, recovery and impacts for Australia. So do look at our events tab on, as well on the webinars. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.